Start with a little bit of food news. Does anybody have any food? Are you our visitor today?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. They're really nice people. Okay. So sort of the other end of the spectrum. How many of you are seniors again?
Yay! How exciting!
Is it good? Is it okay?
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. This is kind of an interesting perspective for you to have. So maybe you have some food news, maybe you don't. I have a little bit. Kind of an unfortunate story. I think it's a series of three NPR stories on diabetes in Mexico. We've talked a lot about diabetes as a food-based metabolic disease in the U.S. And I just think it's worth underscoring the point, you know, that since the Western diet is problematic because of its emphasis on cheap calories, then it would not be surprising to find people in poor countries increasingly eating cheap calories and getting the same diseases that that we get. And the unfortunate thing is that that's what's happening. And it's happening in countries where people don't have access to medicine like we do. And so anyway, it's just kind of it's a food and social justice topic. And we are, I might as well remind you now that we're entering into our food ethics unit. It's kind of the last segment of the course. So we'll be talking about a lot of ethical and social justice related issues about food. Any thoughts about that? Any connections with that? Okay, yeah, so you can catch those if you want to get more detail about that. Mm-hmm. You can. I have two crazy movies. Well, one, let's see, only one's crazy. Two movies to recommend to you. Both of them came up on Amazon Prime. I was kind of looking for a free video on a slow night. And one is called The Gut, and it's made by these French people. And they just had an incredible amount of money for the graphics. So the graphics for this movie they're almost disturbing. They're kind of, you should definitely watch this movie. How many, do you guys have Amazon Prime? Maybe you can find somebody's account. And because I don't think it would cost you that much to watch it. But it might be, since it's a documentary, it might be on Canopy. So if anybody's on the Foley site, you could maybe check Canopy for me. So this is kind of a French movie focused on French researchers. It is a documentary, but the graphics are just really strange. For instance, you've got a lot of images of French bellies, which is kind of not so bad necessarily, but then there's a montage of bellies with talking belly buttons, which I found a little disturbing. And then they're getting into the idea that the gut brain has psychological implications. So they wanted to imagine like psychoanalyzing your belly. So they came up with this graphic of a person with a belly on their head instead of a head. It's very strange. So you might want to check it out. The underlying research is actually pretty interesting. For instance, 95% of our serotonin may be manufactured in our gut, and the nervous connections that we've already talked about how your gut brain is about as big as a cat's, right? And so they talk about that. They make a point that even though the title of the movie is The Gut, Our Second Brain, the researchers in the movie make an interesting point that the gut's really our first brain, right? I mean, if you think in evolutionary terms. And so the idea that we evolved to create a second brain that communicates with our gut about our appetites and our feelings about food is pretty intriguing, and it's got a lot of researchers going. In a similar vein, I was referring this movie to a friend of mine who I might have mentioned. He works at Chez Panisse. He's a Berkeley grad, same age as my kids. And she referred me back to a new book that I missed on the microbiome, and that's a book by Ed Yong, I Contain Multitudes. So if you're interested in more reading on the microbiome of the gut brain, you might want to check out that book. It just came out in the fall last year. Okay. Any thoughts? Anybody? You guys good? It occurred to me today we're talking about vitamins, and if we could have done class outside, we could have made vitamins while we were talking about them. That would have been nice. It doesn't often happen in a philosophy class. The digital food movie is okay. It's got some interesting segments. If you're interested in technology and food, it's got some really interesting segments, not just about industrial food, but how people are using technology to improve organic farming. There's some pretty clever things in there, things that are new to me. Okay. You guys are very quiet. You look really happy, though. So is everything okay? Yeah? Yeah. No food adventures lately? Okay. Okay. Great. Well, let's get into our material a little bit. I did have a note on we have a couple of interesting themes to develop today. I did want to make a note about practicality. Last time, you remember, I shared with you just a few ideas about practicality here, and we talked about, you know, maybe if you were designing a diet, what would you want, how would you assess whether it was practical, and I gave you this list. I don't want to go into that again. I do want to add a couple of points in case you're thinking about this. Because those are kind of small design issues, right? But when you're designing a diet, you really have some kind of larger. Sorry, flipping around. You really have some larger design issues. Like, for instance, in my diet, and many of you are experimenting with diets like this, I want to have a diet that's sourced primarily from plants and vegetables and some animal products, and I want it to be pretty fresh. And so a practicality design problem that follows from that is that fresh food goes bad, you know, quickly, and that it's and that sourcing it is can be time consuming. So last time we talked about, you know, we've got different methods for dealing with that, like freezing foods and so on. I just wanted to add one that I should have mentioned last time, and it's a pretty important one. It comes up kind of with our vitamins today, because there's also you can also use fermentation in a couple of ways. Ascorbic acid, or vitamin C, has a preservative effect on fruits. So if you want to have fresh fruit in your diet, and you mix, and if you like mixed fruits, you can actually make fruit salads that last 4 to 5 days if you've got ascorbic acid in them. So pineapple, any citrus fruit is a good thing to throw in there. Likewise, if you want to make a kind of a protein vegetable, there's a whole category of cold salads that are basically protein vegetable salads. You can partially ferment. Well, the protein source, like beans or chickpeas, isn't going to go bad over days. You might worry about the vegetables, and again, you can use apple cider vinegar to partially ferment onions, and that actually reduces. If some of you have trouble digesting onions, that kind of addresses that problem, but it also preserves the onions. And then, of course, one of the reasons oil and vinegar dressings are so ubiquitous in world cuisines is because the vinegar and the vinegar has a preservative effect as well. So a design problem I had in my diet was how to have a lot of fresh food in my diet, and one of the solutions is to, of course, make things and freeze them and eat, you know, make a big pot of something and eat it for days. We talked about that last time. But I wanted to point out a couple of other methods, and that is to, you know, to be able to basically partially preserve or ferment or pickle foods. And you can take this further. I mean, there's a real movement now toward toward fermented foods. I don't quite get with it. It's not quite my thing, but that's another approach, which is to actually buy. Somebody bought this for me. I never used it. There's a German crock that is designed for fermenting foods. And if you get it, did any of you try that? That might be something to try this summer. I don't know. You can make a bunch of sauerkraut and things like that. So that's kind of another illustration of how you can have a design principle in your diet. In this case, a big design principle, not just like the practicality ones. And then you kind of think about how you want to work around it. I won't get into it now, but you know, another one for me is that I actually want to eat a lot of my calories during the day. That's a subjective preference. There's no health benefit that I'm aware of. It's just I don't want to get to the end of my day. Subjectively, I don't want to get to the evening and just have to eat like 800 calories. That doesn't appeal to me. So again, that's a practicality problem. So you can solve that partly by having foods that last 4 or 5 days. If that appeals to you, and then being able to take those with you into the middle of the day. Okay. Did any of you get a chance to listen to the Gastropod podcast? I was so excited when that came up last night. Please put it on your list. It's really good. In fact, I'm embarrassed to admit that it'll probably replace the very detailed reading that I assigned to you today, which you may or may not have gotten completely to. Yeah. Did you? Oh, you're good. Okay. So check that out. I did manage to listen to it because I was just too excited not to. And so I did want to make a couple of points from it before we get into our reading. And from the Grasser reading, I'm going to just kind of highlight a few things that I think are really important in it. And I apologize if that was a long reading for you guys. Some pretty interesting stories in there, though. So I'll bring those out for you in case you didn't get to them, and then we'll take it from there. Okay, so let's see. From the Gastropod podcast, this is a kind of a confession. Catherine Price's book did come out back in 2015, I'd reached my saturation point with that kind of book, Now I regret it because the podcast is all about her book, and they interview her, and she's really good. And so Vitamania should be on your summer reading list for food. And again, I might maybe sample some of that book for next year. A couple interesting things that stood out from this podcast that I don't think were covered in the Grasser. There's some overlap with the Grasser thing, the chicken experiments described in both. But let's just get some of these things out for your notes if you're curious about them. And really, note-taking at this point as spring term seniors facing the last few weeks of a course, you know, really, let's just think practically. Take notes on things that interest you. Take notes that help you get back to the issues that we're highlighting, because you are going to write two short essays during exam week. And that's unless you've got, many of you have other projects and papers that you've chosen to do in the course, right? But that's really the last writing that we'll really need to do from a mandatory perspective. So your notes are really just kind of to help you so that if you get a topic, I'm thinking I'll do one mandatory topic and then a choice from like three. And so you'll write two essays and they'll be pretty short essays. Yeah.
And when is that happening, sorry?
That's going to happen the last week of the semester, so that's our exam week, and we don't meet for that. You do that at home, you upload it to the Dropbox, and we're done. Now, lots of other projects that you guys are doing are coming in around that time, too. If it's possible for you to finish your journals, like by the third or fourth week of April, that would be great, especially. And if you can finish the diet review stuff by then, that would be good. I'm still waiting to hear from Jenny about our cooking class. I hope that comes together. I'm not sure. Okay, so relax, enjoy the material. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in it. I'll try to bring some of that out. But please, feel free to interrupt with questions. You guys are starting today's class kind of quiet, so I don't know if that's quiet contentment or your minds are elsewhere, like on your futures. Is that possible? Yeah, okay. That's all right. Well, we have this time. Let's enjoy it. So to get some notes started, the interesting thing about vitamins is there is no chemical definition of a vitamin. We thought for a while they were amines, right? But the point, let's start some notes on vitamins. I mean, vitamins just are the tiny little amounts of things that we've noticed have huge effects, because the history of vitamins, as you know from your reading, is the history of initially of nutrient deficient diseases, right? That like scurvy, beriberi, pellagra, that really plagued humanity and still do. You learned in your Grasser reading that pellagra, I'm not sure. Was rampant in the southern U.S. and through the 19th century, especially the first part of the 19th century. It was a horrible disease. If you looked up images, you have an image in your nutrition chapter, but if you look up images about it, it's a really devastating disease. Another point for your notes is that these are. So some vitamin nutrition is measured in milligrams, but some is measured in micrograms, which is millionths of a gram. Catherine Price makes the point in this podcast that this is like a tiny fraction of a crystal of salt. So initially, it's just hard to imagine that really small amounts of things could be so consequential for our diet. And when we get into the history of nutrition chapter, we're going to see that there were some real biases preventing people from accepting the idea that vitamins are real and that they could be so consequential. So some odd details. It's kind of a strange detail. You might you wouldn't pick this up, you guys didn't have enough time to listen to this, but we actually, I didn't know this, we actually do make B12. You know, B12 is a serious concern for people who don't have animal sources in their diet. We make B12, but we make it in the part of our intestines that it's too low to be to have the machinery that reabsorbs nutrients. So these people, mammals like that, like us and rabbits, are sometimes called hind fermenters because we ferment, because these vitamins, as you read, are partly a result of an irradiation or fermentation process. And so sunlight's involved in a lot of vitamin production and irradiation. So rabbits actually solve this problem by eating their excrement. But we happily have not evolved a similar strategy. The other interesting detail is that you learn in this, and I didn't know this at all, is that vitamin D that's added to milk, when you see milk fortified by vitamin D, comes from a process involving irradiation of sheep wool. And I was so curious about it, I just kind of looked it up. This might be kind of interesting for those of you who know the chemistry. It's really an interesting process. Price discusses in this podcast how vitamin production doesn't happen in the U.S., but our vitamins come from other countries, and they often come from very complicated supply chains. So the wool comes from Australia and finds its way to China, where we get vitamin D from it. And so there's kind of complicated chemical process there. But the sources of vitamins are pretty interesting to know. Vitamin C story, I think we mentioned this. We used to be able to make this about 65 million years ago. Our bodies were able to produce vitamin C without, we didn't need vitamin C from fruit. We still have the gene. And so if you're an enthusiast for, what's that gene editing technology? CRISPR. Yeah, you could imagine that someday we could CRISPR the human genome so that we would be able to actually go back to making vitamin C the way we used to a mere 65 million years ago. So let's get what I really liked about the podcast, though. The strange details are neat, but here's a critical thesis to put in your notes, because this connects with a lot of things we've talked about earlier in the semester. And she has a critical thesis about the connection between the vitamin industry and the processed food industry. And it's new to me. I should have read her book, you know, but no time like the present. And that is that industrial food, it's just kind of got my attention last night. Industrial foods can't exist without vitamins. Isn't that interesting? I never thought about it that way. Industrial foods can't exist without vitamins. If you took the added vitamins out of industrial food, we would have massive food vitamin deficiencies, and we would start to experience. So when you couple that with the idea that vitamins aren't made in this country, Price makes this interesting observation. There's a real vulnerability in our food security, right? If all of these countries that make, now presumably this isn't going to happen, so you don't. I'm not saying it's likely, but presumably all these countries that make vitamins and we don't make them, it would be a serious problem if they stopped selling us vitamins. So she kind of makes that point about the geopolitics of it. But it's also interesting to think that we couldn't have. The vitamin extract. So we learn about vitamins first indirectly by these experiments that we'll talk about. Then we get the chemistry to identify the chemical. And then the third step is that we learn how to reverse engineer the chemical and produce the vitamin in huge quantities synthetically. So the sheep wool example is an example of that, because you don't. In other words, we don't extract. This is kind of good for your general understanding. We don't extract vitamins from natural foods and put them in pills. We learned how to, with the vitamins, all the vitamins that you can get through supplements, we've learned how to synthesize the vitamins from other processes, like the one I showed you for sheep's wool. And that's important partly because vitamins, you can put this in your notes this way, vitamins are really one of the first industrial food products. We tend to think of processed food products as post-World War II, right? The big explosion of food products. But it's really kind of vitamins that are the first industrial food product, and they make it possible to have what I've pejoratively called degraded industrial food. The only reason you can feed people with degraded industrial food is because you're going to add the vitamins back in, right? Are you guys with me? Can we get the nonverbal going? Okay, good. So that raises the critical question of whether, from a food security standpoint, it's really there isn't a real vulnerability in vitamins. Second critical thesis. So that's a critical thesis about the kind of vitamin industrial complex, if you want to call it that. But the second critical thesis she raises, and you don't push this too hard, but is that, and I didn't put it up in the notes here, is that she basically says you shouldn't really buy a you shouldn't really need to buy multivitamins. And when we turn to our textbook chapter and we look at, we pull some details out of that today, we're going to see that a lot of vitamins aren't really, you're not really at risk, put it in your notes this way, you're not at risk of vitamin deficiencies if you have a diverse whole foods diet. So while half of Americans take a vitamin supplement almost every day, in light of this earlier thesis about the connection between vitamins and processed foods, it's starting to kind of affect my thinking about it. I was going to go out and buy a new bottle of multivitamins. And now I'm kind of, any thoughts on that? Well, maybe you need to hear more from the rest of the class. I don't know, but yeah.
That's pretty hard because my dad is the same way, but I also shadowed a physician this summer, and he was all about multivitamin when you pass a certain age, and like he's a doctor, and that's what the scientific training says. And my dad says no, like he has different theories about.
Yeah, as you know, people get psychologically get attached to their food theories, and so given the uncertainty of the science of nutrition, especially of supplements,
there's like some articles on like manufactured ascorbic acid is a different chemical structure than like naturally occurring.
Right.
Ascorbic acid,
vitamin C is a good one, right? Because that's a good example of one where people megadose because there are pop theories about megadoses of vitamin C curing cancer and crazy stuff like that. Seemingly crazy stuff like that. Maybe if you believe it, that's fine. Yeah.
So I'm from Portland, and I never took multivitamins, but my mom, I don't know, she's like 50 now. And she's started to take half-dose vitamin D supplements.
Yeah, that's an older person's one. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Absolutely.
It has to do with age or something, but obviously Portland, like, you don't get a lot of sun, and so a lot of people...
Right,
like, I grew up there, so it was never a big deal, but I know, like, a lot of people that move from, like, Colorado
or California.
Really struggle with that.
Absolutely. There's an adjustment. There's some evidence that the adjustment happens, though, that we actually have the ability to store enough vitamin D. But, like, many years ago, when we moved from University of Texas at Austin, where I did my degree, to here, I went from a place that had 300 days of sunshine to what we have here. I don't know what it is. It's not 300 days.
It's 160.
Is it 160? Is that what Portland is?
No, that's here.
That's here. Portland's last. Yeah, right. Good, yeah. So I'm tilting toward, and it's just kind of, I don't have a lot of authority on this, but I'm kind of tilting toward a selective supplement. So this is, the multivitamin is one thing. And after we go through the evidence of toxicity in vitamins, and then the real question is, the real evidence is, if you have a diverse plant and animal-based diet, natural foods diet, there's just a lot of vitamins you don't have to worry about getting. So her advice really was more nuanced than I represented. It fits in with what several of you said, which is that if you have special medical conditions, if you're getting older, then there's certain things that you might start adding to your diet. But there might be reason not to take multivitamins, and I guess I was subjectively put off by them by the idea because she brought out the connection to processed food more there. By the way, niacin, this is just nobody has a confirmed theory about this, but taking a lot of niacin that stimulates your appetite, niacin reinforcement occurred in the same time period as increase in calorie consumption among Americans. So you could suspect, right, that niacin could be, that taking too much niacin is maybe a bad idea because it's going to artificially stimulate your appetite, right? Okay, just some details from the podcast I just wanted to throw in because I thought she did. I really like Ratzer. I'm sorry if it was too long and detailed for you, but I'm just going to pull out what I think are the most important things from it that I think we might be able to make some philosophy use out of. But I thought she brought out some really interesting points. Vitamania should be on your list. Okay, any thoughts about that? Let's move on. have to admit, this is kind of a cranky complaint of mine, but I think it's unfortunate that right as things get green and warmer, all the machines come out, you know? Does that bother any of you? Yeah, it's like, and I know that, you know, the people working in plant don't, I mean, it would be cruel of me to suggest that they should all go back to manual implements and so on. But, you know, it's, yeah, I don't know, it kind of bothers me. Anyway, all right, let's focus on vitamins. By the way, okay, so one of our big themes today is going to be why, let me just put, I identified some of these for this morning. Let me just put a couple of them up. So, I'm not putting saying this right, but one of our themes is going to be, I'll put it as a question for your notes. Why did we have so much trouble identifying vitamins? I mean, what's the and one of the reasons I dragged you through this chapter from Gratzer is because he tells enough stories to see the pattern. And so just to make it not suspenseful, let me just give you the answer to the question. We were biased by a number of things, including the discovery of antibiotics, right? The Pasteurs discover antibiotics, and it sets off a real paradigm shift among scientists to thinking that, wow, if something's wrong with us, it's probably a germ, right? So put it in your nose this way, there was a bias toward germ theory created partly by the discovery of antibiotics. That reminded me of another story, not related to nutrition, that I mentioned here, is another recommendation for your summer reading. I mean, once you graduate, you guys have a lot of time to read books that haven't been assigned to you. Hope you have a long list. And one of them I'd suggest would be this book by about the Dr. John Snow called The Ghost Map, recently written book. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have put the date there. But this is a book about the discovery of the causes of cholera. And this happened in 1850 in a London outbreak of cholera. And John Snow was the doctor who kind of broke through the miasma theory. So in your notes, miasma theory is the theory that airborne germs cause diseases. And I think there are some airborne germs that cause diseases, obviously. But we overinterpreted disease causes as germ-based, again, because of the discovery of antibiotics. And so that's a theme in the history of nutrition that's going to turn out to be a really difficult hurdle to get over. All right, so let's get into some of the stories, okay? So I'll just isolate a few of these stories for you. The rice disease, so-called because it was discovered in Southeast Asia, the Japanese discovered it in their own culture, but also the Dutch discovered it in Dutch colonies in Indonesia. So that's one of the reasons you have Christian Eichmann, you have Dutch scientists involved here. But Takaki was a Japanese scientist who was trying to diagnose this. And he had the ingenious idea of sending two ships off with different diets. And by the way, a lot of vitamin deficiency diseases weren't really highlighted until we had a lot of people taking long ocean voyages, because obviously on a long ocean voyage you are separated from the sources of your natural diet. So Takaki did this experiment with two ships with different diets, and nobody on the ship with fresh food got beriberi. Okay? So as you know from your reading, beriberi is caused by a deficiency of vitamin B1 or thiamine. So that's a data point, but it doesn't get recognized. I don't remember the year of that, but it doesn't get recognized. Then the Dutch experimenter, and this is a really neat experiment. It's described in the gastropod episode as well. This Christian Eichmann, he's totally imbued by the germ theory. He's totally convinced that, like most scientists, that that deficiency diseases are not deficiencies of vitamins. They involve the presence of a causal factor like a germ. And by the way, if we could just digress on this, because some of you with psych backgrounds know this. I can't remember the name of this bias, but there's a really strong bias in human psychology toward looking for causes that are present rather than noticing things that are absent. And you can test this psychologically in a lot of ways by for instance, you can give people trigrams to figure out, like letter patterns with three letters. And if your trigram is based on a rule of, say, the presence of a letter, you know, like the letter K is going to occur in all of them, then people will get that. You know, when you show people lots of trigrams with some pattern based on the presence of a, of something, people eventually figure that out. When you show people trigrams that are based on a pattern of something being missing, it's really hard for us. So the point for your notes would be that psychologically, in addition to the discovery of antibiotics, right, we also have a psychology that works against thinking about causes, thinking that a cause of something could be the absence of something. Does that make sense? It's a really strong psychological bias. It's something you should know about, because a lot of times when you're troubleshooting things, I recently experienced a lot of frustration trying to troubleshoot this lawn tractor that I'm trying to fix. I'm really bad at that. But my biases in troubleshooting always come out in situations like that, because it's often the absence of something that you should be aware of rather than the presence of something. Okay, so Eichmann does this chicken experiment, and what he's doing is he's trying to infect the chickens. So he has a control group and he has another group. He's trying to infect the chickens with the germ that he thinks causes beriberi. And it gets very frustrating because at some point neither... So in the first round of the experiment, the test group doesn't get sick, but he's given them the germs. So what's going on with that? So he figures, well, he must have done something wrong. So the next round of experiments, in the next round of experiments, let's see. Well, I'm sorry. I might have confused. Let me look this up real quick. So on page 138. Yeah, here, I can just read it to you. Right. One group he injected with bacterial cultures, the other served as controls, all got beriberi. So I had it wrong. In the first round, everybody got sick. All the chickens got sick. So he's like, well, how could that be since I only infected one? So he figured that he might have inadvertently infected all the chickens. But then... he gets a new round and he cleans the cages and he gets a new batch of chickens and nobody gets sick. And the crucial point is that he learns that between the first round and the second round, the chickens' diet went from polished rice to whole brown rice, and it was a change that he didn't authorize and he only learned about it after the fact. So that leads him to the conclusion that he was resistant to, that in fact beriberi might be caused rather by the absence of something in polished rice, right? The absence of the bran in polished rice. So he kind of gets religion on this, and he writes it, he writes up his results. There's these other researchers associated with him. We don't need to go into that. He writes up his results, but crucially, the results only get printed in a Dutch medical journal. Then later, this guy Hamilton Wright, this British guy, comes along and does this experiment. As you learn from this chapter, a lot of these experiments are completely unethical. They're just devastating nutritional experiments done on captive populations of mentally ill or prisoners. So Wright goes into this asylum in 1905. This is somewhat later than Eichmann. And he suspects, notice how strong the germ theory is. By this point, they know it's about polished rice. But instead of thinking that what the problem is that the polished rice is missing something, he's persistent in this idea that, well, there must be something toxic about polished rice. So they're hanging on to the germ theory. And he knew about Takaki's research, and it tipped him toward the nutrition factor. And then the interesting thing in the story, and this is why I identify this as resistance in all of the stories, is that he produces authoritative evidence that it is about nutrition. And then he cites Eichmann's earlier writing, and then everybody starts making fun of him, of the Dutch guy. And they say, well, you know, that's just absurd. He must have been eating too much rice. He's, you know, they actually just make, they ridicule him. And so the point for your notes is that it not only takes us a long time to overcome the bias toward germ theory, but most of the scientific community at this point is so committed to germ theory that even when you produce these stunning, stunning experimental results, the most authoritative people in the field are saying, no, that you must have done something wrong. So that's the pattern that I want to show you. I think that'll kind of speed us along a little bit, so especially if you did the reading. So that's kind of the pattern with beriberi. Now let's turn to pellagra. And as you know, this is a deficiency of B3. It's a horrible disease. Sicily is the hero of the Kwashiorkor disease, which I finally learned the origin of the name of, so I'll share that with you. So pellagra, as you know, is this niacin deficiency. It's a horrible disease. It produces dermatitis, diarrhea, dementia, and death. It was widespread in the U.S. There were lots of theories about it at the time, including the idea that it was a fungus contaminated. It was observed among poor people who ate mostly corn. Right, so that's important for your notes. And the problem is that corn is very deficient in niacin. So a quick remedy of pellagra, which eventually you hear was Goldberg did, is to distribute brewer's yeast. So there was an outbreak in 1927 in Goldberg in the South, and Goldberg goes through and says, okay, you know, everybody needs to mix some brewer's yeast in their drinks, and it had a seemingly miraculous effect. But not to jump ahead, let's follow Goldberg's thinking. You get to hear about his medical training and all that in his background, but then he winds up at Georgia State Sanitarium for the insane. Again, you know, nutritionists are doing these experiments on captive populations. And he's wondering immediately, how come the staff aren't getting sick? If it's an infectious disease, how come the staff are healthy? And here's another example of the resistance to this theory. The people around him say, well, but the staff are, they're naturally more robust than the crazy people. The crazy people are crazy, so they don't have as good genes. So the point for your notes is that we have a lot of ideological explanations. We produce ideological explanations to resist believing that it's something missing in our food. Our allegiance to our diets, our overcommitment to our diet psychologically is really strong. As we're going to see when we look into philosophical diets, people develop real zeal for their special diets, sometimes to good effect, sometimes not. Okay, so the point for your notes is that counter-explanations are offered to save the germ theory. There's a lot of resistance in the South, even after Goldberg is giving lectures in Harvard and everybody's hailing him as a great researcher. So here's one of the reasons I wanted you to read this chapter. He gets so frustrated with people not accepting his experimental results that, because you have to imagine the amount of human suffering that pellagra involves in the South in the U.S. at this time. And this is a really serious. If you don't believe me, look up some of the images of pellagra. I don't want to put them on the screen. They're gross. It's a really horrible disease, and he's a committed doctor. So he does more experiments. In this case, he got the governor to approve for him to do a second experiment on prisons this time, on prison population. And it was very extreme. They brought the experimental group to near death. And they finally had to halt it because the control group went to near death and the experimental group got the healthy diet. And they gave pardons to all the prisoners who had the bad luck to be in the control group. People still didn't believe it. There was still resistance. So what he does is, and this is so gross, if you read it, you know what I'm talking about. Some of you remember this, right? This is really disgusting. To lay the infection theory to rest once and for all, Goldberg resolved on a program of what he called filth parties. He, Wheeler, and a group of 6 volunteers with strong stomachs, Mary Goldberger among them, assembled at the U.S. Pellagra Hospital in Spartanburg, South Carolina, they systematically exposed themselves to blood, nasopharyngeal secretions, epidermal scales from pellagra lesions, urine and feces from patients. First, they injected themselves with blood from severely affected victims. They rubbed secretions from mucus sores in their nose and mouth. They swallowed, I'm sorry, does anybody have food here? This is horrible, right? I mean, I mean, you can imagine this, how frustrated this guy was that nobody was going to believe this. So he just like said, okay, you think it's an infection? You know, we'll show you. And he got pretty sick, actually. I don't recommend it. But he didn't get pellagra.
He got terrible diarrhea.
Yeah, I think he got diarrhea. All in the cause of science, so yeah. Isn't that cool? Okay. So that's a measure of the resistance, if you have to do that much to counteract it. Absolutely disgusting. Okay, so again, the pattern for your notes is we have multiple sources of resistance to identifying a missing factor, a deficiency factor causing a disease. All right, so we won't just go through all that. So then the next hero of nutrition, the other reason I like this chapter is you get to meet a lot of heroes of nutrition and science, and that's kind of neat. Because in every case, these are the people who managed to get their head in a different place than the dominant community was. And that's also true of our Dr. John Snow, who figured out the cholera transmission. It's in the water. It's not in the air. I'm just going to call it protein deficiency disease. You learn in this reading that kwashiorkor is called that because it comes from an African word that means the sickness of the older child. It's kind of an interesting detail, right? The second child who's born is often sent off to a wet nurse, often an older woman whose milk is maybe not as nutritionally sufficient as it should be. And so it's not an unusual disease in poor African countries. And it's a nutrition deficiency with horrible consequences. This woman, Cecily Delphine Williams, was a Jamaican-born Brit. She did her research in Ghana. And she produced these studies. She was a scientist. She produced these studies. She'd send them back to Europe, where she was educated, to Britain, where she was educated. And they would just say, no, this is pellagra. This is not a protein deficiency disease. You're just misdiagnosing it. And there's a lot of condescension there. There was condescension to Goldberger because he was Jewish. There was condescension to Cicely because she's a woman and in science at this time. So it's a really neat story. Eventually we find the breakthrough and we realize that it's a deficiency disease of protein. Okay. The last segment here is... really the saddest. One of the ways that we study, one of the historical ways that we've studied nutritional deficiencies is by studying populations that are experiencing extreme hunger and famine. And so you got a few stories here I'll just remind you of. The first was from the siege of Paris in 1870. The Prussians had Paris under siege. Very sad stories. They actually went and ate all the zoo animals. Even the beloved elephants in the zoo, and they and then they ate at the dogs, and so we get accounts of what it's like for a population to go through extreme food insecurity. And one detail that you learn is that you don't really die. Very few people die of starvation. People die of illnesses and infections that occur because of their compromise. Their immune system gets compromised. You also get the story of the Dutch hunger winter. Again, a way of documenting starvation in a large chunk of the Netherlands right at the end of World War II. You get stories of Germans. There's lots of stories of Germans experimenting on human populations. Maybe the worst one, and it ends the chapter, is... this is just very sad. I'm sorry to bring it up, but it's just really part of our study. The Germans, in a number of situations, tried starvation as a method of extermination. And in this one very profound case that I'll just mention to you, if you didn't get to the end of the chapter, in the Warsaw Ghetto, Germans were trying to starve the Jewish populations of the ghetto, and this, and they knew what was happening, of course, and this Jewish population in particular was had many authoritative scientists and medical doctors, and they meticulously documented with amazing detail. They documented, made minute measurements of the declining health of the children and adults, and this was about half of the reports that they produced during this. So the point for your notes and the point for your imagination is that they're documenting their own starvation. And we do get information from this, but half the reports are lost. The other half kind of have to get secreted away during the rest of the war. And really, by the time they're published, you know, medical science has kind of passed that. So the research wasn't actually consequential. But it's just, do you feel it? I mean, it's a profound example of humans studying their own starvation and really detailing what happens to people when they lose food security. Okay. So that was why I thought about going through this chapter of the history of nutrition, because I think it's good for us to appreciate just how difficult it was to get to the point where we understood nutrition through vitamins. But there's a few, So we've talked about a couple other things. We have vitamins and food security. We talked about that when we were talking about the podcast. Maybe industrial vitamins are not good for our food security. And then turning toward the chapter on vitamins, I think there's a lesson about small, I'm just going to call this the lesson of small amounts. And I'll just use it as an example to say something about my own education about nutrition. When I was learning more about nutrition, at some point I got to the phytonutrients, these other micronutrients that are fairly recent, that we don't know much about. They occur in really tiny amounts. And so there are a lot of writers on food who say, phytonutrients, who cares? We don't know what they do. They're really tiny amounts. But the point for your notes would be that vitamins occur in really tiny amounts. Remember I was telling you about millionths of a gram? And so I don't want to like oversensitize you to the importance of all these micronutrients, because we don't really know what a lot of the phytonutrients do. But we need to know that people who have diets that don't have a lot of them often have problems. So again, we're kind of at a frontier in vitamin science that kind of makes us suspicious maybe of the next group of nutrients that we just know a little bit about. So let's get into that with the vitamin chapter, if we could. Did you guys work through your vitamin research? I mean, your worksheets here. Or maybe we should see if you have any results. Maybe we could just start with this. Some of you have this on your computers, or you could pull it up, maybe we could kind of look at what you came up with here. How about four vitamins directly related to disease conditions? This should be pretty easy. Somebody start us off on this.
Vitamin D deficiency leads to rickets.
Right, good. Yep.
Vitamin C leads to scurvy.
Right. What happens if you don't get enough vitamin A? Night blindness. Yeah. Okay. I'll see if you. I mean, it's also good to kind of as you go through the chapter. I hope you picked up some knowledge about food sources that have these vitamins. I'll go through two when I present my notes on this chapter. I was interested in focusing on micronutrients that we don't have to worry about, because I thought that would be helpful. Okay, so that's kind of where my notes went too. Maybe you guys have some things from your worksheets that can be brought in here too. So this is a little technical, but I just kind of wanted to follow the chapter in terms of toxicity and just a couple of random notes in some cases. So the chapter divides into fat-soluble and water-soluble vitamins. And the reason I'm focused on toxicity is back to the practical point about vitamin supplements. I remember shopping for vitamin supplements after learning a little bit about this. And if you, I don't know if you guys have had, maybe you have experience to bring in here, but if you go to like GNC, you know, which sells a lot of vitamins, you can really see, if you compare bottles, you can really see that some products are really designed for people who want mega doses. And so learning about the toxicity of vitamins is pretty important, I think, for making sure that you aren't overdosing on vitamins. And some of the problems that occur when you take too much of a vitamin don't show up immediately. Some of them do. Like if you take too much niacin, have you ever taken too much niacin? What happens to you? Yeah, you get what?
You get flushed and itchy.
Yeah, you get kind of skin flush and so on. So there's some immediate effects from taking too much of vitamins. But some of these vitamins, I was interested in bad effects that are kind of long-term. And I was also interested in bad effects that come from mega-dosing, because I think that's something that's in the culture that we do, and there's good reason to not do it and to be worried about it. And ironically, the healthier your diet is, naturally, the more likely it is that you would be taking too much of a vitamin by taking a supplement. So again, that goes back to Catherine Price's advice at the beginning of the hour from the podcast, that maybe multivitamin supplements aren't really necessary if you're kind of a normal, healthy person eating a plant-based diet. Okay, so let's just kind of go through this and see if you guys have any notes to add. There's a couple of places where it might be good to add some comments. Maybe you guys have some knowledge to add to this. So you learn in the chapter that there is such a thing as vitamin A toxicity. So you can kind of keep an eye on that. But we need a tiny amount of vitamin A measured in millions. There are some interesting differences between vitamin D2 and vitamin 3. And I wanted to tout this article, which I think I've recommended to you guys before, especially those of you who... Oop, wait a minute. No, that's a different article. Hang on a second. Yeah, this is still relevant. This is relevant when we get to B12. I thought... Let me find the article I was referring to. Came up in our food news early in the term. Yeah, this one. Those of you who are working on special diets, vegan, vegetarian diets, I really strongly encourage you to look at this article again. It's relevant to today's class because it kind of takes a nutrient by nutrient approach to special diets, and it's real specific about both vitamins and minerals and other micronutrients. So, let's see, get back to our reading notes. Oops, sorry. Okay, so the reason I shifted to this pediatrics thing is that they do have a section on differences between vitamin D2 and D3. Strict vegans don't. If I'm right about this, check me. But if I'm not mistaken, vegans source their D from D2, and so there's a discussion about the relative value of vitamin D2 versus D3. And you should drill down on it even if you're just doing a vegetarian diet, but especially if you're doing a vegan diet. Vitamin D has toxicity. It can actually lead to calcification of your soft tissue. I didn't notice how common that was. But vitamin E, so in your list of vitamins let's kind of create a list of no worries and maybe concerns. Because you definitely, if you don't take action, you're definitely not going to get enough vitamin A, right? And you're definitely not going to get it, and you should be concerned about your vitamin D. But you probably don't have to be concerned about E, right? You do have to worry about, some of these I kind of almost want to double check. You see my method here? I'm kind of interested in focusing us on the vitamin micronutrients that we have reason to worry we're not getting in our diet. And some of these, some of this shakes out if you kind of follow the chapter with that in mind. So, for instance, vitamin D has a rare deficiency. Vitamin K, I thought, was one that you needed to be concerned about. Vitamin C is problematic in excessive amounts. It can cause intestinal distress, not any kind of distress. Kidney stones. It's not clear that it's toxic, but it can cause you difficulties. So you probably shouldn't megadose vitamin C. And probably if you have a decent diet, you probably aren't worried. I've checked vitamin C in my diet, and it's like, you know, probably more than I need. Yeah.
Was there like an upper limit for vitamin C in the book?
That I thought there was. No, there's no toxicity, so they don't give an upper. I think when there's no toxicity, they don't put an upper limit. You can check if you got it handy. But yeah, that's the kind of thing I want to track in this. I think we have enough time to do it. So, vitamin K is related to coagulation. It's called the coagulations vitamin. And then you shift to the water-soluble vitamins. Oh, I'm sorry, we were doing vitamin C already. So vitamin B1 is definitely something you need. You're getting it if you aren't eating primarily if you have a diet with natural foods, you're getting plenty of B1. So I would put that in the category of no worries. B2 is important for you. There's no toxicity, so there's no upper limit. But you do need to worry about B2, I think. I think you need to know that your diet has plenty of B2. Niacin deficiency is very rare for us. That's the one that you would get if you ate primarily corn as your carbohydrate. So if you're eating bread that has brewer's yeast, or if you're eating meat, there's no worry about B3. B6 is a good example. I wanted to highlight B6 because it's a good one of the things we've been tracking in our nutrition study is getting away from the belief that there are single nutrients that have single causes. So, you know, the macronutrients, right, carbohydrates, protein, and fat, kind of lead you to think and led researchers to think that, hey, maybe that's all you need. Maybe your protein metabolism is really just about how much protein is sourced through amino acids in your diet. And the point for your notes here, I think it's a really important point, it's something that I've run across a lot, is that vitamins and micronutrients provide coenzymes that help speed up metabolic processes. So you can be getting a lot of protein in your diet, but if you have a vitamin deficiency of, say, vitamin B6, which aids protein metabolism, then you could experience a protein deficiency, even though the amino acid sources of protein in your diet are sufficient. Does that make sense? You guys with me? So the point for your notes would be that you should get away from thinking about single nutrients having single health effects in your diet. When you start to learn about metabolism, you realize that there's just a lot of contributing factors. So your protein metabolism is going to depend, in this case, on your vitamin B6. B6 is weird too, because if you don't get enough of it, weird things happen to you. Like you start to, of course, if you have uncoordinated movement all your life, I don't know how you notice a B6 deficiency, but there is an upper limit on B6, although they didn't identify it as toxic. Okay? Just a couple more here, and then we'll wrap it up. So these ones at the end are really examples of vitamins that you could put in your... folate is something that's not, it's widely available, so folate would be no worries. And B12 is a huge, that's one where I do recommend that you look up not only the Academy of Pediatrics, what they say about B12 and sources, but also this other reference from WebMD that I think I pulled up earlier that really goes into that. So it's not, I don't mean to raise a kind of scare about vegetarian or vegan diets. I think you can have a perfectly healthy vegan vegetarian diet. And starting on Thursday, we're going to start to look at the moral and ethical considerations that lead people to special diets of all kinds. But this is the time to make the point, I think, that for a vegan diet, B12 is a concern. So I think we have to kind of put it in a separate category. If you're eating meat, you're getting plenty of B12. I was reading a little more about this. Even lacto-vegetarians like me who are eating dairy and not meat might have a concern about B12. So that would be... So in that shift from multivitamins to looking for single vitamins, that would be one that I might get. I might get like a B12. I think there was one other that I figured I might get partly because of my age. Okay, so that's kind of what I had in mind to do. Pantothenic acid is not something you need to worry about. It's important, but it's not something you usually have a deficiency of. Biotin is something that you usually don't get a deficiency of. And then the phytochemicals, as we said, there's kind of a big... This is a new area of research. Phytochemical research is one of the reasons why the new dietary guidelines actually break out vegetables and ask you to have different types of vegetables. That's why they say that maybe you should have green vegetables and some dark vegetables and some light vegetables. Okay, gang. I don't know. Let's see. I mean, maybe this was just pretty factual stuff. I didn't think it had a lot of opportunities for deep discussion. Let's see if there's some questions. What do you think? Where are you guys? You're already in your futures, aren't you? Okay, let's break and then start reading the material for next class, and that's going to get us into a different unit, okay?